teacher in the honors program. I also co-chair the philosophy, poetry, and religion seminar at the Harvard Humanities Center, where we host speakers once, sometimes twice a month, which I mention now because the speaker tomorrow at Harvard at the Barker Center, sort of near the Harvard bookstore, is Michael Sells. And if you'd like to encounter another facet of his work, I invite you all to attend that tomorrow in Cambridge. His talk is tomorrow is titled Poetry and Mystical Apophasis in the Islamic Tradition. Apophatic theology and mysticism, one of the subjects Michael has contemplated and written about extensively, speaking very roughly, is the notion that we know God by not knowing God, by realizing the radical disjunction between our mode of knowing and what God is or is not. Because apophatic thought has structural affinities with atheism and other intellectual currents that turn away from conventional devoutness, a strong book on apophatic mysticism can attract a wide intellectual audience. But this only begins to explain the compelling appeal of Michael Sells' book, Mystical Languages of Unsaying. It is the greatest modern work on mysticism I know, and one of the clearest, the one with the clearest implications for the philosophical and literary discourse. Sells uncovers a profound intellectual poetry in the Greek, Christian, and Islamic apophatic mysticism, which he translates himself from Greek, Latin, Arabic, medieval German, and medieval French, of Plotinus, John the Scot, Ibn Arabi, Meister Eckhart, and Marguerite Poiret. They are shown to be great thinkers wielding a masterful, deft fluidity of language that could, with the help of Michael's insights, refine the discourse of much modern thought. The significant modern experiment in fluidity of thought labeled postmodernism can sometimes become an end in itself, a kind of stasis of unrelenting fluidity that could benefit immensely from Sells' fathoming of these always fresh, venerable figures in several traditions. There is in this book, as in all of Sells' work I know, a gentle drivenness toward what is nourishing, a discernment that selects the kinds of awe, sublimity, and vastness that are humanly digestible, the kinds of profundity that are fun and kindly disruptive, the kinds of diversity that lead to intellectual feasting. I also recommend with similar intensity, but I won't speak about it at similar length, The Lovely Stations of Desire, with its translations of 23 poems from Ibn Arabi's Translator of Desires, and some of Michael's own poetry. And I will mention in passing other important works he has written, translated, and or edited, Desert Tracings, six classic Arabian odes, Early Islamic Mysticism, The Cambridge History of Arabic Literature, Al-Andalus, and Approaching the Quran, The Early Revelations, which is a breakthrough in revealing the beauty and power of a text that has not survived well in previous translations. His honors include the Guggenheim, Fulbright, and National Endowment of the Humanities Fellowship, the Columbia Arabic English Translation Prize. Sells' ability to move between the mystical and the broadest intellectual and humanistic thought foreshadows another chasm he has traversed between the scholarly academic world and the concrete world harboring political injustice and widespread human suffering. I think a lot of us harbor a hope that the modes of thinking and feeling we cultivate through years of thoughtfulness and our chosen discipline might bear good fruit outside the contours of academia, amidst the dire needs and ambiguities of the uncircumscribed world. I am moved by the way Michael Sells negotiates these transitions between worlds, and by his freedom from stationing himself in any one world so that he can be stationed in all of them. Just a couple more things. His 1996 book, The Bridge Betrayed, Religion and Genocide in Bosnia, received the National Prize for the Historical Study of Religion. The book was cited for its analysis of the way myth and ritual can be manipulated to motivate and justify genocide against a religious minority, and for its revealing the humanity and hope beneath the violence in Bosnia. In 1993, he co-founded the Community of Bosnia, a nonprofit organization dedicated to resisting religious persecution, racism, and genocide, and to working for a tolerant multi-religious society in Bosnia and throughout the world. He has also developed one of the most extensive internet sites on human rights and war crimes in Bosnia. So I'm very grateful that you're here, and I look forward to your comments on a berserk world that yet can be fertile of much goodness.
First of all, I'm going to make sure that you can hear me. Can you all hear me well? I want to thank Marty Cohen for his hospitality and the honors program that hosted me this afternoon. It's a pleasure to get to know the Boston College community. And I would like also to come back to the very good news about the Islamic Studies program that was announced earlier, and why I think that's really at the heart of what I'll be talking about today. I'd like to begin with a very graphic image that will set a number of questions that will be explored in this talk. When the Taliban dynamited the huge towering Buddhas, the largest freestanding Buddha statues in the world last year, a number of Muslim and non-Muslim groups tried to raise protests and tried to alert the world that something was going on in the Taliban that was beyond the boundaries of normal, even normal fanatical religious statements. And something was beyond the boundaries of even normal conflict and warfare. They weren't paid attention to a lot at the time, and sometimes they were mocked because they were allegedly caring about buildings instead of people. But the point was that when someone does something like that, in that violent way, that out of tradition, out of keeping with the tradition that they claim to be representing, that there's a violence against a number of things, including people, buried in the symbolism. And that soon became apparent. Those Buddhas had stood for centuries. They had seen the successor Greek armies from Alexander the Great, Hindu and Buddhist armies and cultures, the great Islamic cultures of the Middle Ages. They had seen the invasions of Genghis Khan and Tamerlane. And through all of this, they survived intact. No Muslim group ever considered dynamiting them or destroying them, just as no Muslim group has considered destroying the Sphinx in Egypt or other major monuments in the world. Those Buddhas had looked over a culture that was in many ways quite extraordinary. The first point I want to make about the culture those Buddhas had looked over was that when people say that the Taliban wanted to go back to the medieval way of thinking, or the medieval period, that's quite the contrary of what was happening. The Taliban destroyed every evidence of classical Islamic civilization that they could find in Afghanistan, including manuscripts, musical instruments, shrines, and other markers of a period in the Middle Ages, which was quite extraordinary. Afghanistan is the area, the present-day Afghanistan is the area from which the great poet Rumi came, who is considered to be one of the most profound voices for religious openness and tolerance in human history. And it wasn't just him as a single individual. He's only the bubble on the surface of a huge ocean of culture that nourished that kind of thinking. The former Afghanistan was the home of Avicenna, the great philosopher, whose work has fundamentally influenced Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and who worked in the various sciences, medicine, and philosophy. It was the home of observatories and a flourishing world of multicultural, multi-religious diversity and interaction. That is not the world that the Taliban wanted to go back to. And the mistake that somehow present-day fundamentalists or extremists want to go back to the past, and that this is an expression of some kind of tradition in the past, is a serious one. It leads to other serious errors that I'd like to talk about briefly in a minute. But the Taliban were not only interested in the Buddhas as symbols. They also engaged in a very strange ritual that they had banned all television and photographs, except for ID cards. But they periodically would allow broadcasters, Western broadcasters, to come in and videotape them, smashing videotapes. And they would invite Western photographers to come in and photograph them, ripping photographs up. And one looks at this and one thinks, what is the inner logic behind this? Why would they go to this trouble? What are they trying to say? The part of the answer is that the version of Islam that they espouse is connected to the version of Islam in Saudi Arabia known as Wahhabism. And Wahhabism has a certain kind of horror of images. When the Wahhabis came to power in the 18th century in Saudi Arabia, they destroyed all images that they could find, including most of the Sufi shrines. And many of the tombs, really, of the Prophet's family, Prophet Muhammad's family. And the Wahhabism of Saudi Arabia, which is one very small aspect of a huge world of Islamic diversity and tradition, happened to be sitting on the world's supply of oil, and that allowed it to gain an extraordinary worldwide dominance in projecting its view of what Islam was, both within the Islamic tradition and outside of the Islamic tradition. The Wahhabi viewpoint became radicalized progressively over the last 30 years. And in the past 15 years, the Wahhabi teachings in the schools have become extremely radical. Osama bin Laden's anger at the Saudi government, the reason he declared war on the Saudi government, was that they allowed non-Muslims to stay in Saudi Arabia. He had been taught by his own Wahhabi teachers that non-Christians defile the holy land of Saudi Arabia. This is not a classical Islamic doctrine. This is a very new kind of thinking. And when the United States had to station its army there after it decided to not to support the revolution against Saddam Hussein after the Gulf War, he became offended that the monarchy was not living up to the ideals that were being instilled under the monarchy's auspices in Saudi Arabia. On some level, then, when Osama bin Laden and other wealthy Saudis financed the Taliban, helped keep bring them to power by intervening in very crucial moments during the civil war in Afghanistan, and helped keep them into power until just recently, they were creating the kind of vision of their vision of a utopia that they would have liked to have created in Saudi Arabia, but circumstances did not allow it. But there's more to this destruction of these images than simply Wahhabism. I believe that something else has happened. What is in there that the television that the Taliban are fighting against? In many ways, their war is against that television set. And on some level, the television set represents a pervasive culture of globalized advertising that is almost irresistible. In fact, for a while I was studying symbols once, and I thought, well, how powerful are symbols? And I began to study cigarette advertising. And I realized that through symbols, by showing sexy people smoking, healthy people smoking, sociable people smoking, alive people, vital people smoking, you could get people to consume a product that will make them the opposite of all those things. And that is the power of symbols and images. And when it's used properly or used well, it becomes almost impossible to overcome. In fact, anti-smoking activists have found that unless they can stop the advertising, nothing else they can do can stop the growth of or the maintenance of high rates of smoking. The power of the advertising symbol, of course, can be seen by the fact that people are paid, consultant firms are paid hundreds of millions of dollars to decide on the exact color of a carton or the exact model to use in imaging a certain product. In this sense, this is my kind of personal meditation on this issue, one could look at the pervasive culture of globalized advertising that is causing extraordinary disruptions across the non-industrialized world that I will be talking about a little later, and within the industrialized world, and say, on some level, at least as far as advertising and television is concerned, these images really are, as the Wahhabis view all images, idols. And they enslave us. They are irresistible. They take us over, and we become their servants. Of course, the Taliban have never articulated a philosophy in the way I've articulated it. But I've tried to read their actions rather than their statements. And I've tried to see, from my own experience in the Middle East, why someone would make these symbolic gestures against television sets and photographs in this way. The Taliban studied the American media. In many ways, they seem rather primitive, living in caves up there now, but they were very, very tuned in to issues of media and communication. The Taliban and Osama bin Laden studied how media shapes representation. For example, when the Iranian militants took American hostages after the revolution in Iran and held them there for over a year, every day the major news programs showed something about those hostages. Almost every news program showed images of those 50 or 60 Iranian militants holding up clenched fists and shouting, "Death to America." But none of those pictures at that time ever were interested in going around the street and seeing what the rest of Iranians were up to, what they were doing, what they were thinking, what their life was like. Those Iranian militants found that if they could harness a violent, shocking action to themselves, they could push all the other tradition out of the way and claim the microphone, claim the image, claim the center stage. And they probably became the most famous Muslims in modern American history, certainly. And they came to dominate the stereotype about Muslims that many had, and that's what, in many ways, what they wanted to do. When Saddam Hussein surrounded himself with Islamic symbols, and he had those hostages there, and he would invite reporters in to see him patting the shoulder of this young boy he was holding hostage, another really compelling kind of repulsive act that gripped people's attention, he was able to harness those symbols and associate themselves with him, even though Saddam Hussein has never had a religious bone in his body and is completely non-invested in any religion. He knew that he could cloak himself under the garment of Islam, and he did so with extraordinarily effectiveness. When the U.S. Helicopter was shot down in Somalia, and an American was dragged through the streets, the sight of that American was repeatedly over and over and over again being dragged through the streets, and it caused such an uproar in the United States that the administration abandoned the policy helping the Somalis, which was actually a successful policy. More than 1 million people were saved from slow starvation, and dropped that policy and immediately left. And Osama bin Laden has since been quoted as saying he saw that and he realized that Americans are the slaves to their television, and if he could control that, if this was the people that you could just show one image of one soldier being dragged through the streets and they would run away, then he was convinced he could destroy the United States as he and his fellow fighters helped destroy the Soviet Union. So it was no accident then that the September 11 attacks were choreographed with extraordinary symbolic power. Not only were symbolic targets picked out, the symbols of the American economy, of the American political system, and of the American security system, but also it was choreographed in such a way that the first attack on the Trade Center tower would cause all the cameras to be focused on the trade towers, and then the second one would hit, and that would guarantee that this would be seen live across the United States. And as one can expect, it's been repeated, especially the first few days, it was repeated continually. Again, associating Islam with Osama bin Laden and making the association he wants to make, that he is the voice and the face of Islam. And so often you had media people saying, you know, that Islam is complex, we shouldn't think of all of Islam as the enemy, not all of Islam did this, not most Muslims are repulsed by this. But at the same time, on the split screen, there is the picture of the trade towers, and the symbols are more powerful than words. You can show some cigarette advertising, and then all the explanations in the world don't really undo it. So in some sense, there's a war going on over the image. And for what I think the Taliban and Osama bin Laden saw was that for the Western world, and increasingly for the globalized world, the television set is the central nervous system of reality. It's where the power is. And if you can occupy it, in the strong sense of the term occupy it, they occupied American televisions for a month, and inserted themselves into the world's consciousness, a world now where satellite dishes have made seemingly most impoverished village able to tune in to dozens of television channels and to be watching this simultaneously. The final point I'd like to make about the Taliban and this meditation on Taliban war and images is their brutal treatment of women. Women wear the burqa in some of the traditional cultures of that region. But to my knowledge, there has never been a central state authority that banned women from school, that banned women from reading or learning to read, that banned women from all work. And to my knowledge, this is a completely unheard of thing in the history of Islamic civilization. Again, why the extremism? Often I think that in the arguments over the station of women or the status of women in Islam or in the West, there's a focus on the veil, and you know, the longer the veil, the more oppressed the woman. But in fact, things are pretty complicated. In Iran, where the chador is worn, a very conservative garment, 50% of university students are women. Women have a higher rate of engineers in Iran than they do in most Western countries. A higher proportion of other major professional fields are women. Across the border in Afghanistan, women weren't allowed to go outside the house. So the question is not the length of the veil, but what is going on in the society. And on some level, I think the Taliban are, if I can interpret for them again, what the advertiser knows is that the central motto of advertising, the kind of the informal model, is sex sells. And you have sexy people on a car, and people buy the car. It doesn't matter how good the car is. You have sexy people selling beer, they'll want to buy that beer. And usually that's women who are still playing the dominant role as the figure of allure in that sense. Male models are still not paid anywhere near as much as female models. So in some sense, if one is viscerally reacting against the pervasive advertising culture, then this notion, that, which in fact where the beauty of human beings and the beauty of women in particular, especially their physical beauty, is used as a powerful marketing tool, then it fits into all the other image thing to just keep the face of the woman as far away from the world as you can. And every time the Western agencies asked the Taliban to treat women better, they actually made it harsher. Now, I'd like to step back from this rather sad story about what happened just recently in Afghanistan to talk about what some of the implications are for the next several decades. And what this means for relations between Islam and some of the Western nations, and also what it means for theories about whether or not Islam is part in a clash of civilization with the West. After the September 11th horrific attacks, there have been numerous columnists, television opinion makers, and others who have said that these attacks have vindicated the theories of clash of civilization, first put forward by Bernard Lewis and then picked up from him by Samuel Huntington. Briefly stated, these theories suggest that Islam is now in a state of civilizational hostility with the West. But more importantly, they state that this civilizational hostility stems from the very origins and basic fundamental values of Islam itself. So it's not a matter of a grievance over one issue that can be solved. It's rooted in the very essence of the Islamic tradition. If that theory is true, then truly the world is in a grave situation, because a war of all of Islam against the West really can't be won by either side. I can't see how it could be won by either side. And it's really horrific even to begin to imagine what it could be. And yet, I think there's something very pervasive in the assumption about a clash of civilization. I'll try to give some examples that do suggest that there is a war against Islam as a whole. Now, if this opinion is correct, as I mentioned, we're in such big trouble that I won't even try to diagnose what we could do. I don't have any kind of prophetic understanding into such huge, deep realities. But if it's not correct, and one assumes that it's correct, it's a very, very dangerous assumption. If you're not my enemy, and I assume that you're enemy, not you're my enemy, and I start acting toward you as if you're my enemy, I start building up my defenses, I start mistrusting your statements, you sense that I'm acting toward you in a hostile fashion, you might become my enemy. And a belligerent attitude toward Islam as a whole, or the assumption that all of Islam is fundamentally at a war with fundamental Western values, could gradually lead to further and further polarization of the Islamic world and the Western world. And it could push out the vast majority of people who do not consider themselves at war, who have very complicated ambivalent feelings about many things, and it could change those feelings into the kind of one simple, linear, hostile reaction that one sees when one is in a mobilized state of war. Now, one of the things that I think the clash theorists do that I think is good and important is they point out the flaws in the Islamic world, and they do this with very persistently and very carefully. And I think that to the extent that in some of these things are true, they're important to take seriously. I think there's been a kind of polemic where those who see some of the problems of clash theory refuse to listen to these people at all. One of the things they have pointed to, and other people have noticed it, and many Muslims have pointed it out brilliantly, is the rise of conspiracy theories around the Middle East, to where it's, you know, that a very high number of people thought that either the CIA or Jews or some conspiracy was behind the Trade Tower bombing. And we're very hesitant to think that this could have been done by Muslims in the name of Islam. And to the extent that one looks at a society and says, gee, how could a society have so many people believing such a extraordinary conspiracy theory? I think it's good to try to reverse the perspective, and I'll try to do that now, and see if there's any place in the United in this society where people believe something in a very popular way that really, from the opposite point of view, seems very, very bizarre. And I'd like to use the example of Iraq, which is such a very important issue right now and could be a tragedy in the next several months, depending on what happens. In 1991, the United States had one of the most extraordinary celebrations in its history. After the Gulf War, the generals and people who ran the Gulf War were given a ticker tape parade down Fifth Avenue in New York. And the then President Bush the Senior received a popularity rating of 90%. And General Schwarzkopf and General Powell became known as the people that carried out this extraordinary victory. And still today, this victory is hailed by almost every political columnist and newspaper opinion maker that I've seen. And when we look back on that, we see that from a technical point of view, there's no doubt that this was a successful operation. A huge amount of army and military was moved, very few American casualties. The Iraqi army was destroyed very efficiently. But on another level, one asks, how could this be considered a success? On February 15th of 1991, President Bush broadcast and had translated into an Arabic an appeal to the Iraqi people, saying, "This war will end and the bombs will stop when the Iraqi people rise up and overthrow, take it into their own hands and rise up and overthrow this dictator." After the Iraqi army was crushed, when the United States Army was moving into Iraq and had complete control over the air and absolute military dominance, the Iraqi people did rise up. In fact, they took 14 of 18 provinces in 2 weeks. They took the city of Basra. They took all the major cities except Baghdad. And Iraqi generals have since said that had the United States just allowed that to happen, Saddam Hussein would have been overthrown by, not by the US Army going to Baghdad, but by the rebels themselves within a matter of days. But instead, General Schwarzkopf authorized Saddam Hussein to use his military helicopters, and the army stopped just short of the Republican Guard unit that keeps Saddam Hussein in power after destroying the units of draftees that really had no investment in Saddam Hussein. And then Saddam Hussein was able to use those helicopters and that Republican Guard under the dominant air dominance of the United States to systematically annihilate the opposition. Because they revolted, they exposed who they were more than Saddam's secret services ever could have done. And although people are familiar with what happened to the Kurds in the north, very few people realize that in the south, entire regions were annihilated. Columns of refugees had jet fuel poured on them and were lit on fire. Entire villages were razed to the ground. Some regions had water diverted for them, drying up their ecology and forcing them to live in shanty towns in Basra. He continued to punish all those associated with this revolt for years. At the end of the Gulf War, during the revolt, the people carrying out the revolt repeatedly contacted General Schwarzkopf and other officials saying, please, just say to Saddam Hussein, you can't fly the helicopters. No response. They begged the United States not to fight for them, but simply to stop the Iraqi regime from carrying out this retaliation. And yet, within a month, the United States was urging that the sanctions that were put on Iraq be kept in place until Saddam Hussein was out of power. An American official stated that the Iraqi people will suffer until as long as Saddam Hussein is in power, and that embargo was kept in place. Also, because Saddam Hussein was left in power, the United States had to station its army in Saudi Arabia, which is why Osama bin Laden and other radicals began their jihad against Saudi Arabia and their attempts to overthrow the Saudi government and attack U.S. facilities around the world. Now, my point is not to criticize people. Decisions had to be made suddenly. I think it was a terrible blunder to ask people to revolt and then change your mind at the last minute. I don't know. There's a lot of discussion as to why this happened. But to look back on what that Gulf War brought and to think of it as a success is, on some level, very hard to fathom. It's almost as hard looking from the other direction as to fathom that people would believe that Jews carried out the attack on the Trade Tower. It was a moral and geopolitical catastrophe. It has led to attacks on the United States. It has radicalized opposition to the United States around the world. It cemented Saddam Hussein in power in a way that he'd never been cemented before. And it has made any future effort to attack Iraq or overthrow Saddam Hussein very likely to gain very little support in the Arab world and possibly to cause a truly dangerous backlash. So my question then would be is not only what went wrong with those folks, the Muslims over there, but also what might be wrong with the way people we think, to have a little self-critical view as one criticizes the other. And then, and this is what I'd like to end on, to look at what is right. And I'd like to talk about three areas of what is right that I think are resources for a possible, completely different way of interaction between Islamic heritage in the West. These three areas are time, poetry, and the Quran. And I think there are areas that show an extraordinary gap in translation. Not only the translation of technical translation, but the larger sense of translation. The why certain things are meaningful that seem so strange to someone outside of that world. In his book, What Went Long, Bernard Lewis outlines how in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century, the Islamic nations took no interest in the developments in the West of certain scientific revolutions, including the development of measurements of spatial matters, measurements and time measurements, and in particular, the clock. They didn't wear watches, they didn't import clocks, they didn't build clock factories, and without clocks, of course, industrialized society can't have synchronized train schedules, you can't have assembly lines. I mean, in many ways, the clock and these measurements allowed the industrialization that in some sense is what the West is partially. So to that extent, his point is, I think, very well taken and very important, that people were not paying attention to some folks over there that they thought were backward, and these folks were doing something they didn't understand, and all of a sudden these folks in a couple hundred years were conquering them with technology that they couldn't, had no conception of. And yet, the other question I think that needs to be asked is, what is right in the Islamic world? What is their sense of time? What might it be like? The Islamic world is governed, the Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar. It moves around constantly. There's never a fixed date on which any of the religious holidays are held. That fundamentally alters the way time exists with the society and with the individual. In addition, the basic time system of Islam as a religion is the five call to prayers, which are made through natural observation and require a precise orientation from wherever one is toward Mecca. It's called, the orientation is called the Qibla. And that precision of orientation, some people believe that precision of orientation and the necessity for being able to make really complicated judgments about time and space using a lunar calendar and in this very rigorous system of prayer times led to an intense interest in the Middle Ages in astronomy and mathematics, and that it might have been the thing that pushed Arab scientists who were studying many things to get so deeply involved in their studies that they ended up adding the zero to the number system, creating algebra, algebra is an Arabic term, and creating an astronomical advance that has led 50% of the star names to be Arabic still today. So that the point that time measurements can be related to extraordinary scientific progress, that they can both result from scientific progress and cause scientific progress, I think is well taken. But what about today? What is the time system like today? When I go to the Middle East, if I go to Damascus or some other place, when I get there, I feel something that I think is very hard to articulate, and bear with me a little bit, I'll give it a try. There's a sense of a constant presence of humanness that is lost in what I would call instrumental time. Instrumental time is time where one is trying to get from one place to another for only one reason. Instrumental time is what leads people to road rage. They're in that car, they're not in that car for any other reason, and if all the time that they're not at their goal, then we are frustrated. And my children know how frustrated I get. I don't think I get to write to the clinical definition of road rage, but I feel the frustration of it. I know what it's like. I live with it. And the world in this country is a world of being stuck in traffic, of linear time. Even though it's very efficient, much of the time is linear, transactional time. Whereas in the Middle East, there's one is bathed in what I would call non-transactional time. I'll give an anecdote. When I went to the Peace Corps and went to the southern village in Tunisia, I went out to buy some goods at a store. And I just wanted to buy a couple things. And I came there, and the store owner was talking to some people, and he was getting very engaged in the conversation, and he would start to climb a ladder to get something off the shelf, and he'd forget what he was looking for, and he'd come back and be engaged in the conversation. I'm waiting there, you know, when it's going to get to me. And then he notices me say, well, you know, hey, you know, I asked him something in Arabic. He says, oh, you speak Arabic, you're an American, what are you doing here? I said, I teach in the school. All of a sudden, one of the ladies who was talking to me said, you know, do you mind if I talk to you about this? But my nephew has a problem in the school, and I'll get your advice. All of a sudden, the store owner's son appears with a tea set, and we're all drinking tea. I get to know these people really well. We're talking about different things about, you know, what are you, a Muslim or Christian? I always have trouble answering some of these questions for a reason that Marty talked about. That gets into an interesting conversation. And then at the end, he gets the items, and in this incredibly skillful way, he just picks up some newspapers and wraps them up into perfect bundles, drops them into the basket. And I walk off, having wasted 2 hours under some views of what time is. And yet, I treasure that experience till today. I remember it till today. And when I go to Damascus or some of these other places, I have experiences like that constantly. In fact, most of my life is like that when I'm there. Now, it's not as efficient, clearly, if under rigorous capitalism, this guy would be driven out of business pretty quickly. And I'm not recommending it as an economic policy in that way. And yet, the challenge is that there's something about that life there that's really, really rich and special. And when I leave it, when I come back to the United States, I feel an intense sense of cultural dislocation and culture shock, which is far more intense than I think that people realize. And I know that people that have lived in these worlds and gone back and forth are constantly feeling this. And so that if you can imagine growing up in a society of non-transactional time, where non-transactional time is the central value, and where transactional time is seen as kind of rude, it's a violation of the fundamental Arabic and Islamic virtue of adab, or kind of open-ended hospitality. If you can imagine living in that society for years, and all of a sudden either your city has been transformed into a kind of modern, hyper-transactional time city, or you're ending up in some city in the West where you're working this way, and you're delighted to have all these opportunities at work and to build up some finances and get all the benefits of this industrialized world, and yet there's something missing, something lost, something profound. And I think the question is not just saying what is wrong, but saying how can industrialized societies and traditional societies, especially Islamic society with some of these deeply held and very richly articulated values, get together and share these values and contribute to one another, so that we can have both economic progress and this kind of human warmth I was trying to mention. Very quickly, I'll just mention two others, and then I would like to have some discussion. Up until recently, the Islamic world was a world in which poetry was absolutely central to life. One of the major entertainments in the Islamic world is people staying up all night with poetry contests. You know, you're expected to recite a poem from the classics. Then maybe someone else would recite another poem. Then you're expected to extemporize on the same meter and come up with a poem on the spot that'll play on this classical poem and also show your own originality. And this poetic culture is completely bound up with the topic of longing for the lost beloved. It's the central motif. It's called ghazal, G-H-A-Z-A-L. And this is the poetic tradition which had a profound impact on the troubadours and has really had an impact on the very origins of Western romantic poetry. In some sense, when we say we and they, Islam and the West, the West has got so much of Islam embedded in its very depth, and Islam has so much of the West, that those terms are a bit artificial. And this is a world of gentleness, of subtlety, of satire, of openness, of a play, of eroticism, of humor. And it's a world that most Americans do not associate with the face of Islam. In fact, when sometimes I'm sitting on an airplane or on a train or somewhere and I'm translating one of these poems or trying to translate it, someone will come up, a stewardess or somebody is sitting next to me and say, what are you doing? And I'm translating some classical Islamic poetry. And they'll look at it and they'll say, I never thought that Muslims would engage in that kind of stuff. And it's an absolute paradigm breaker. And yet this is a world that's alive, it's present, and it's a world that has so many of the kind of deeper, tender feelings, sensitive feelings, thoughtful feelings that are important to the culture, vital to the culture, and yet for various reasons, both because of the way some Islamic leaders present Islam, because the way the media has now only wanted to see that presentation of Islam as Islam, they don't believe other presentations are authoritative, and because of the politicized controversies in the last 50 years, and for other reasons, this area of incredible wealth and beauty is very, very little translated in the wider cultural sense. Most Americans have probably read some poetry of Rumi translated and Americanized by the translator Coleman Barks. And many people think, well, that's an exception. But as I mentioned, Rumi was just the tip of the iceberg. Finally, people say, what's the Quran all about? Is the Quran really as people say, if you kill your enemy, then you'll get 70 virgins in heaven, as some of these constant absurdities come up. And of course, some people believe that, just as Timothy McVeigh had ideas about Christianity that I won't get into, but are equally amazing. But when one says, you know, what's the Quran about? It's almost always, what's its position on violence? And I think it's a very important question. And one of the things Bernard Lewis says, and this kind of judgment I think is so dangerous, he said, well, unlike other religions, Islam was founded by a prophet who is also a warrior, who is also a ruler. And then he draws several conclusions, meaning this means that there's an obligation built in within Islamic tradition that the Muslim should either convert or destroy all non-believers. And I think that's a dangerous step. I would say that it's very important to have a cross-cultural study of religion and violence. See how religion is used in violence. I was, as Marty mentioned, immersed in that in Bosnia. And I'd suggest that there are several areas one could look at. One, the whole notion of monotheism. There's only one God, therefore all other gods are false. Maybe they should be destroyed. A lot of thinkers are questioning, how can monotheism ever live in a world of many religions in a truly, deeply, profoundly tolerant way? And I think it's a major discussion now going on. The second is the divinely mandated holy war. So not only Muhammad fought divinely mandated holy wars, and not only Moses, but Joshua was ordered to carry out a divinely ordered genocide, exterminating the Canaanites, man, woman, and child. Then there is the Promised Land. The Promised Land has been such a powerful metaphor for liberation in Passover Seders and in Martin Luther King's struggle for civil rights. And yet the same texts were used by those who enslaved South Africa. The Afrikaners had those texts in their hand. And when they and that was for them. They were given, this is their Promised Land. And were used by Christians for centuries when they occupied and took over areas in North America from the Indians. Even nonviolent passages can have extraordinary consequences. Of course, the crucifixion of Jesus has been at the center of the allegation that Jews are Christ killers and led to pogroms and persecutions up through the Holocaust. And in Bosnia, the Muslims were viewed as Christ killers because they were viewed as responsible for the death of Prince Lazar in the Battle of Kosovo in 1389. Who in Serbian culture is a Christ figure, and this is called the Serbian Golgotha, and that mythology was systematically used by the Serbian religious nationalists during that genocide. Then if there's the issue of hell and heaven. If one believes that people are going to go to hell if they do or believe things that you don't believe in, then there's nothing you can possibly do to them that's not better for them than what will happen if you allow them to continue their acts as they are. And that was the logic behind the Inquisition, of course. And finally, there's the apocalyptic war that Mark Juergensmeyer has studied so well, where people see themselves as in a war between absolute good and evil. They use the book of the apocalypse. And I watch this at night, in the middle of the night, on some of these TV stations, Christian right TV stations, and that people are living this apocalyptic war. And many of them are waiting for the war in the Middle East, hoping it will come quickly, because there's one brand of apocalyptic spirituality that believes Jesus will not return until there's a big war in the Middle East. But once one gets beyond the violence issue, why is the Quran meaningful to people? What touches them? This is the thing that's so hard to get at. This is where people come to me and say, you know, I went to the bookstore, Mike, and I picked up the Quran, and I got into about 13 pages or 14 pages, and I didn't know what was going on. It seemed cold, alien, aloof. And in many ways, I think that that reaction is almost inevitable if one just goes up and picks up the Quran and starts reading it in English from beginning to the end. That's not how Muslims usually learn the Quran. They usually start out learning the short surah, short chapters that were thought to have been revealed to Muhammad at first, which are in the very back of the written Quran, and which speak directly to humankind without all the Arabic place names and tribal names and warfare and issues that are in the other, some of the other surahs, and ask the human being, what is the meaning of your life? And in a very profound and deeply moving way. And just very briefly stated, when it's recited in Arabic, and most Muslims do not believe that the Quran exists outside of the Arabic recitation, when it's recited in Arabic, the Quran has a combination of majesty, of power, and of intimacy, as if God were both a God of majesty, but also a God of tenderness, speaking almost as if he were speaking, as the Quran says, closer to us than our own heart. And those two things coming together, I think, is why the Quran has that distinctive power. When Muhammad was asked, where's your miracle, if you're a prophet? Moses had a miracle, Jesus had a miracle. The answer in the Quran is, this Quran is the miracle. And for people who hear it in the Arabic, that claim makes sense. The statement in the Quran is, if any human being can compose anything like it, try it. If you can do it, the Quran's a fraud. But if you look at it in English translations, it's hard to understand how that claim could be so compelling. So finding ways to bridge these translation gaps and to allow people to touch these deeper areas of human feeling, I think, is a way of reaching the humanity of human beings. And all those conflicts in Palestine and Iraq and Saudi Arabia are intractable in the political way.